Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Our guest today is Lydia Hopper, co-editor of Chimpanzee Memoirs, Stories of Studying and Saving Our Closest Living Relatives, published by Columbia University Press and released just in April. Her co-editor was Stephen Ross, and I'll let Lydia tell you a little bit about this great man, who I had hoped I would be having a conversation with today as well. Lydia is an associate professor and director of behavioral management at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. She's an adjunct scientist at, and was previously assistant director of, the Lester E. Fisher Center for the Study and Conservation of Apes at Lincoln Park Zoo. Steve was the director of the Lester E. Fisher Center for the Study and Conservation of Apes as well, and the co-editor of The Mind of the Chimpanzee, and with Lydia, Chimpanzees in Context. So we've been fascinated by chimpanzees for a long time. Why? Because, you know, they're our brothers and sisters in a way. We know they use tools, they look like us, they have complex social lives, empathy, humor, intelligence, and family, and lots of other coincidental characteristics, just like we do. And like us, they can also be a violent society, as some of the essays, some controversial, including Jane Goodall's, who started all this. She explores in this collection that topic. And then the remainder of the essays are by many, if not most, of today's experts on this wonderful relative that shares 99% of our DNA. So here to tell us why there's such a fascination by so many with these animals is Lydia. So thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be here. And yeah, we all miss Steve in this moment. I personally have knew Steve since 2005. We first met at a conference many years ago, and I worked with him at Lincoln Park Zoo from 2012 until 2021, when I made the move to Johns Hopkins. Steve was the most strong advocate for chimpanzees in anyone that I've met. Everyone is in my field is very passionate about their work and very dedicated, but Steve had a singular focus and love for chimpanzees. And I think this book was really the culmination of the many questions that he and many of us receive in our career, which is, how did you get to work with chimpanzees? How did this happen? What inspires you? And we, in talking, and I can talk more about the origins of the book later, but in talking, we realized there were many books out there about chimpanzees, but there were a scarcity of books describing the people who study chimpanzees and how they got to be in that position. And that was something that Steve was very keen to share and to inspire that next generation of primatologists who will surely continue this great tradition.
The interesting thing about the beginning of this book, Steve had a great introduction to the book, which I really enjoyed reading. And then he spoke about what most Americans think of when they think of the study of chimpanzees is Jane Goodall. And I remember I'm old, so it wasn't when I was a child, but I do remember seeing her on talk shows, and she was such a lovely person. And there's so many videos, and actually all of you can find them on YouTube. There's so many of them, and they just underscore what the book is about. And the essays are so funny in a way, because everybody is so passionate and so fascinated, and just it's hard to imagine how devoting so much time in their lives on one subject, but then you realize, you know what, there's nothing better that you could be doing. It's funny because as a bookstore owner, I saw a documentary and they were talking about, well, what would you do if you weren't selling books? And one of the guys goes, what else is there to do? So why don't you talk a little bit about Jane, because she kind of started the ball rolling.
Yes, absolutely. And I think Jane's influence is indelibly marked in this book. As you mentioned, so many of our contributors were either directly mentored by Jane in their careers, so folk like Anne Pusey and Elizabeth Lonsdorf, or were sort of indirectly inspired, you know, reading about her early expeditions or seeing those early National Geographic documentaries, right? So her work is a thread that weaves throughout this book. And her work really fundamentally changed how we think about chimpanzees. And that's not to say that folk in Africa, of course, did not already know about chimpanzees, were not already well aware of their capabilities. But I think what Jane did was sort of personalize it and bring that knowledge and bring those stories to a much wider audience, and particularly an audience in Europe and America. And I think in particular, and she talks about this too in her chapter, I think another aspect of her work that was sort of revolutionary at the time was her desire to name and think of each animal as an individual, right? And I think it was much more common at that time to study a species as a collective. And I think Jane's approach by naming the individuals, even though this was, you know, a scientific faux pas at the time, because it was thought that she was anthropomorphizing the animals, I think that allowed her to understand them as individuals, to look at their life histories, to look at their interpersonal relationships. It may be ways that really sort of shaped how we currently do science. You know, now it's definitely the norm to study primates in that way. And so I think that's sort of a really important legacy. And, you know, I think many of the animals that she describes, you know, many of the chimpanzees that she describes, other folk mention in their chapters, and even the people that haven't been to Gombe, haven't met these chimpanzees personally, some of us feel like we know them. We've learned about them through Jane's work. We've learned about them through subsequent scholars' work. And so these really are sort of, you know, celebrities in a way in our field.
Yeah, it's funny because first you realize, you think, okay, Jane was a woman in a man's world. That's one obstacle she has. So you think about, okay, that's why they didn't like her. And then they also didn't like her because she did anthropomorphize these creatures. They almost feel like friends. And everyone gave them really cool names, better names than we have. And
yes.
Then the third thing that she did, which really bothered everyone, was this concept of attributing violence to a tribe or a group. And then that became controversial because it implied that violence was a trait that we all shared rather than something learned. It was something that we were hardwired to fight each other. And then when you look at, well, she touches on it, but Richard Wrangham, he wrote The Demonic Male, which in retrospect, he probably should have thought of a different title. And even he thought that too.
Yes, yes, he acknowledges that.
There's an extreme title. So why don't you talk a little bit about, you know, because I had no idea, and I had no idea really that they would kill animals and eat them. I just thought they'd be eating plants.
Yeah, I think there's sort of two things here to pass out, one of which is that chimpanzees, like many predator species, will kill other animals to eat them. So small bush pigs or even other primate species, so smaller monkeys. And in fact, in some areas, so there's a population in Uganda, a really large population of chimpanzees, the Ngogo chimpanzees, that have almost sort of decimated some monkey populations in the area because they are such efficient hunters. So I think that's one aspect that was revealed, that chimpanzees hunt, and not only they hunt, but they sometimes even work together in coalitions to hunt. But I think that perhaps the more unnerving side of it that certainly sort of Richard speaks about in his work is this sort of coalitionary aggression against other groups of chimpanzees and the way that chimpanzees defend their territories and go on border patrols. So you see males in a line walking the edge of their territory to sort of ward off other groups and sometimes attack and kill individuals from neighboring groups. And I think it was this aggression that really sort of unsettled folk, because it's not just killing to survive, to eat. There seems to be an intentionality about that. And I think then that makes chimpanzees seem even closer to us than maybe we were comfortable at that time thinking about, that there was this sort of parallel in the way that our society operates and then other animal societies operate. So I think there was that sort of unnerving characteristic to their aggression. Yeah.
It is unnerving. But then look at our society today.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's the thing, right? It holds a mirror up to our own behavior. And I think that's sometimes what we're uncomfortable looking at. And I think with chimpanzees too, some of this territorial aggression, we would see overkill. We would see males attacking other males sort of in quite a vicious way. And then it seemed in a way that was more than just to kill them, but to sort of inflict pain. And I think that too sort of, yeah, was what really caught people's attention when that was sort of first documented.
It's interesting when you talk about holding a mirror up, because I think John Matani was talking about, well, they're all talking, everybody kind of mentions, one, they're helping somebody. Two, they're learning something, which is basically what we're here on the planet for. and documenting it for other people to know. And then you think, then one time he's sitting there and he goes, he thinks, I think I'm the luckiest person on earth. And that was such a nice thing to say. And then also, like I do sometimes when I sit by my pond, I think, you know, there's generations and generations and generations of human beings before me that have sat in the same place, thinking the same things. And there's a passage in there where it kind of resonates back to our common ancestor, which is, I can't pronounce it right. Hominini.
Yeah, hominini. Yeah.
Yeah. So talk about that, the common ancestor concept, because that's really what some people embrace and some people kind of shy away from. You know, I'm not a chimpanzee. I'm not anything like them.
Yeah, I think there's many reasons that people study chimpanzees and spend their careers dedicated to understanding them. And for many anthropologists, chimpanzees and other primates represent the sort of the living component of a way of sort of looking at evolutionary processes in real time. So we share a common ancestor. And I think one thing that's sort of important to sort of dissolve is sometimes I get asked, you know, well, if we've evolved from chimpanzees, why are there still chimpanzees around? Why is that? Why are they still there? And I think the way to think about chimpanzees is that they're our cousins. So if we think of our family tree, it's constantly branching. So chimpanzees are one branch and we're another branch. It's not a sort of linear that chimpanzees became humans. It's that we split. And so I think by studying chimpanzees, we can look to get hints at, well, if chimpanzees do this and we do this, this was probably a shared thing that may have been conserved and shared by our common ancestor, particularly if we think about tool use, tool construction, and maybe various sort of social systems. It's a way of getting a glimpse that sort of complements the fossil record and the other sort of archaeological artifacts. And in fact, there's even now a growing field of archaeological primatology. So doing sort of archaeological digs, if you were in sites where chimpanzees now live, to look at tools that would have been used many thousands of years ago by chimpanzees. So applying those same techniques.
I guess we should go back and kind of set the stage. And Steve, in some of his interviews, does that very well. And it's like, I guess we're talking about the middle swath, as he would say, of Africa is their territory. From the Atlantic. You talk about not only the territory, but as he discusses in these interviews, how many are left from how many there were and what you're doing. That's the most important thing, I guess, what you guys are doing here in the States.
Yeah, so chimpanzees typically range around equatorial Africa. So that's sort of, as you described, that swath of Central Africa all the way from, you know, all across the continent. And I think what's really important to note about chimpanzees is, I think for many folk that the sort of the mind's eye picture of chimpanzees is animals living in a lush and dense jungle, and oftentimes at the top of very, very tall trees. And while that is the case, and that's the way in which many chimpanzees live, and particularly, you know, those at Gombe that we're very, very familiar with, where Jane Goodall studied, chimpanzees actually live in a range of habitats. So there are chimpanzees, for example, in Senegal that live sort of in open bushland, sort of in a savanna environment where there really aren't so many trees. It's much more open. The temperatures are much hotter. It's a much drier climate. And so I think this is really important to think about. And that's why we were really keen to sort of get a real range of folk contributing to this volume so that we could speak about chimpanzees in sort of all the ways that they live. And this was also reflected in the book that we published before this, Chimpanzees in Context, which again talks about chimpanzees in different environments. But, and I, again, as to sort of answer your question fully about their habitat, and again, this is touched upon by really, I think, without exception, all of the authors in our book, is that their habitat in the wild is under increasing pressure from human activities, whether this is mining or deforestation, or even the seemingly simple act of building roads to allow connectivity can bisect habitats or introduce disease and domestic animals that have these sort of indirect influences on the health of wild chimpanzee populations. And so I think, you know, what many of the contributors to our book are sort of actively working on is seeking ways to conserve chimpanzees that works in collaboration with the local communities. So we're not just sort of annexing off sections of land that are then the sort of, you know, perfect sort of vacuum of space for the animals to live, because that doesn't respect the local peoples and it doesn't work in collaboration with the local people. So I think that's a real key theme that I think comes through our book, is this drive to conserve chimpanzees, but also our drive to do this in a really active, collaborative way with the people that live alongside chimpanzees and have done for many, many generations, you know, long before Western scientists were in Africa studying chimpanzees.
Yeah, when I first got the book, I thought, oh, these essays are going to be written in the past. And then I realized these are all current. These are all things that are happening today. And everyone wrote it. I hate to say it, but I didn't even know Jane Goodall was still with us and is still an activist. And yes. So her essay was written contemporaneously with the publication of the book. So yeah, there were even mentions of COVID and the pandemic as we went through, which really surprised me. So all these essays were written for the purposes of this book, or culled from other writings, or
how? No, absolutely. Everything was dedicated from this book. So in 2016, Steve and I co-hosted a meeting at Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago that was the fourth in a series of meetings that had originally been founded by Jane Goodall. And these meetings were to bring together scientists who study chimpanzees, conservationists, activists, welfare scientists, people working with chimpanzees in the wild and also in captive settings. And this book arose from that last meeting. And we realized there were a lot of people at that meeting who were either just about to retire or would be retiring soon. And we really wanted to capture their stories and to sort of have a way of sort of commemorating the early work that they did, whilst also bringing in the voices of folk actively working in the field still to this day. So that was really important to us. So we reached out to our colleagues, who some of whom had been at the meeting, some hadn't, and we invited them to participate. And you know, for some of our colleagues, this was a new adventure for them, because these are scientists who are very adept and very skilled at writing sort of scientific reports about their work, but not all of them have written in a sort of reflective way about themselves, right? As scientists, we actually are sort of trained to remove ourselves from the science and be objective. And so this was turning that on its head. And so we did it in two ways. Some folk wanted to be interviewed. So a number of the people, we literally called them on the phone and interviewed them and transcribed their interviews and then edited those into essays in collaboration with them. Other people wrote essays by answering a series of prompts that we gave them. We had some certain questions that we wanted people to touch on. So for example, chimpanzees that had influenced them or what motivated them. So yeah, every contribution to this book was written specifically for this book. And yeah, as you say, in the current moment, we wanted to reflect sort of what's happening here and now.
There was a little bit of almost, you could kind of see in some of the essays that they were out of their element. It was almost like not pulling teeth, but a little difficult to get their back and their backstories. But they all, the funny thing is, every single one of them seems to have felt some kind of affinity in this fashion as children or as youths, or the one guy who's the picture of him at 2 years old climbing a tree looking like a chimp. I forgot who it was. It was a Japanese
guy. That was Tetsuro Matsuzawa. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So that was really cool. And then, you know, Richard Wrangham, he could have been, which I didn't even know, studying the condocraniums of frogs, but somehow serendipitously, they all kind of switched to chimpanzees, no matter how they started out.
Yeah, I think, yes, you're right. That is a common theme, that so many people had this early affinity to nature or to animals, even if it wasn't chimpanzees specifically. I think they all seem to describe this common thread, as you say, this sort of lure of understanding the natural world. And you know, John Matani, who's one of our contributors, actually wrote to us afterwards and thanked us for this opportunity, because I think, as you say, it's a different experience for many of them to reflect on their careers and to talk about it. And yeah, he sort of noted to us that he found this a very pleasurable experience, and that I think this comes through actually in his essay. You mentioned earlier that he talks about the joy of being surrounded by the chimpanzees and how that's sort of his place where he feels in his element. And it was lovely to create a space for these people to provide that aspect of them that's often not captured.
It's funny because now talking to you and also just looking, I'm not ignoring you, I'm looking at the table of contents. And I'm wondering, okay, where's your essay, you know?
So for me, yeah. So I wrote, Steve and I decided, we sort of decided to take the back seat a little bit. We wanted to allow the voices of our contributors to come forward. So we did the bookend. So Steve wrote the foreword and I wrote the afterword. Originally, we had thought that we would be in there as sort of named contributors. And then sort of the book was a very organic process. We had this sort of vague idea for actually a number of years and sort of grappled with it because it was different to other projects that we had worked on. And in doing it, we were so loving the stories that everyone else was sharing that we really wanted to just create a vehicle to tell their stories rather than to sort of overwhelm it with our own contribution. So we've sort of, I guess, smattered some personal details of ourselves in the forward and the afterward, but we haven't sort of written dedicated chapters ourselves.
Well, that's okay. Just like you put them on the spot, why don't I put you on the spot now and
Sure.
tell us your story?
Okay. Yeah. So I guess like all of the contributors, I have loved animals all my life. So Steve, I think, always knew he wanted to work with chimpanzees. That was like a childhood drive and passion for him. For me, it was animals, period. I had many, many pets growing up. I grew up in the countryside in England, a very rural area, and there were cows and sheep everywhere. And so I spent my, you know, this sort of a very idyllic childhood playing outside regularly. But I didn't know that this was a job. I didn't know that somebody would pay you to get to study primates. And what I think really fascinated me personally and what continues to fascinate me is how animals make decisions, why they choose to do what they do, how they navigate their world, how they make choices, problem solve. And the only sort of animal career I knew about as a child was being a veterinarian. And to me, that wasn't as fascinating because in most cases, in my mind, the animal was anesthetized. And so you weren't seeing them moving and making choices. You were working on their anatomy. And so I really didn't think that this was a career. And it was really just a number of very fortuitous incidents throughout my sort of education, getting to do different classes. So I studied psychology and zoology and got to study under some amazing primatologists, even as an undergrad. And that alerted me to this whole field of primatology and then the opportunities within that. So I would say I'm somewhat of a generalist. I really love all animals. I particularly love primates. And so while Steve was, I think, had this laser focus on chimpanzees, I'm sort of more open to all of the primates for sure. But yeah, so that's really how it came about. And it was in undergrad that I learned that this was a field, and then through my graduate degree, sort of pursued it much more strongly.
I always think when you said serendipitous, isn't it funny how life kind of makes decisions for you? You think you're making
yes, yes.
One day, one thing happens and it's like a moment of epiphany.
Yes, so you said that, you know, many of the contributors spoke about the other species that they may have ended up studying. You know, I did my undergraduate degree at Liverpool University in England, and at the time, Louise Barrett and Robert Dunbar, who are sort of two very famous primatologists in the UK, were lecturers there. And so I took classes from them. But I do think about, like, what if they had not been there and I'd been taught by a big cat specialist, or, you know, then maybe I would have been studying lions today. So I really think there was some serendipity. But I think primates to me are so special. And that's why all these years later, I'm still spending my career studying them and working with them.
What's the strangest pet you had when you were a kid?
Oh, strangest pet. I don't think I had many, but nothing particularly strange. So all the sort of typical cats, rabbits, hamsters, guinea pigs. But my father is an entomologist and kept bees. So we always had bees, and my mom always has chickens. So there were like a real variety of animals around. I'm not sure the bees we count as pets maybe, but they were definitely like a part of the family in a way. You know, we ate their honey for breakfast every morning, and their beehives were at the bottom of the garden. So I think that gave me a healthy respect for, you know, creatures of all species.
It's funny you talked about you didn't know that anyone would pay you money. And then I thought, there's nobody in this book who remotely did any of this for money.
No.
Because you're not going to become the one percenter by saying.
No, yeah. And I think you spoke about the passion that's evident in everybody's contributions. And I think that's really it. We are driven by different things, but I think the strength of the drive is the same. So whether it's a drive to conserve wild chimpanzees, to enhance their health and well-being in captive settings, or to study questions about their cognition and behavior, I think the level of that drive is the same. And, you know, it's that drive that keeps me going, but it's also other people's drives that keeps me going. You know, I'm really fortunate to work in a field where all of my colleagues are as passionate about what we do as I am. And particularly when we go to, you know, academic meetings, conferences, and I get to hear, you know, a whole swath of people give very enthusiastic talks about what they're studying. And even if it's not a question that is particularly of interest to me, their passion and their interest in it sort of refuels my own passion in my work. So that is hugely, hugely fortunate. And for me, much more motivating than a paycheck.
Yeah. Yeah. Same thing with the bookstore. Owning a bookstore is not going to make you a multimillionaire. But, you know, but the thing is, you know, people come, you make people happy. It's the same kind of thing. You know, you're helping people, you make them happy, and you're learning an enormous amount, because that's really all you do with books is learn.
Yes. Yes. And share knowledge, right? And share your own passion. You know, the books that you find that engage you, you get to share them with other people. And so there's definitely parallels there in that sharing.
Yeah, there's those same kind of moments too, because like one time a 12-year-old kid came into my bookstore and bought War and Peace, and I couldn't charge him for the book. You know, it's the same kind of thing. How could you charge someone? Right. You know, it's the same kind of feeling. However, playing devil's advocate to a certain extent, because all of you are so laser focused, when you look at Carolyn's essay and that unusual story about, you know, these chimps were bothering the tribe and they were fighting with guys in the, with farmers. And then when the chimpanzee is injured, three trucks, which is never going to happen anywhere to a human being in Africa, three trucks come from different settings to save the chimpanzee, and the tribe is so upset. You come here, we're hurt, but you're interested in saving the chimpanzee. You bring blankets for your chimps, but not for us. And I thought, and then she says, and I'm thinking there's a certain naivete in this, she says, well, we wanted to explain to them, we need to explain to them they're as important as chimpanzees. And if you get down to the bottom, aren't they more important than chimpanzees? And does your focus sometimes, I am playing devil's advocate, but doesn't—
No, it's a very important and it's a very good question to ask. And I think we were keen for all of our contributors, when they felt comfortable doing so, to be vulnerable and to admit lessons learned, I guess. And for sure, for her, that this was one of those lessons learned. And I was speaking at the beginning about the importance of working with local communities, not just sort of railroading in. And I think that is something that we all as a community need to get better at, but are getting better at. There's been an enormous amount of growth in that, in the way that we work and sort of provide resources and provide opportunities for the people too, because none of this can happen without that collaboration and respect and cooperation. And so I think that, yeah, there's a few stories in here where folk, I think, are vulnerable and describe these scenarios that they handled maybe in the past in not the most effective way, or not the safest way, or not the most, yeah, appropriate way, to be honest. And so I think that's what we wanted. We wanted this to be an honest book and a book about humans, right? Making choices and doing in the moment what they thought was the best, but also showing ways that we can definitely do better moving forward.
And then the other one is the succeeding essay by Anne Pusey, where, and I thought about this because there's so many trigger warnings, especially dealing with people in the bookstore now, with cancel culture and Me Too. And she's talking about Gilka waving her beautiful pink bottom. And if you said that today about a woman courting or attempting to be dating a guy, you would be removed from society. Isn't that fascinating? Because again, there's a certain amount of hardwiring that people today are not even going to suggest is possible with regard to courting or being the most healthy or attractive of mates. And that's why you choose the mate. Isn't that interesting? It's you say you can say those things again if you compare the species, the animal. You can say those things easily about chimpanzees, but if you tried saying any of that stuff about human beings, you'd be canceled in today's culture.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think one thing that's particularly interesting about some of the early work, so for example, some of Anne's work looking at, you know, the females in the society is actually a lot of the early work really only focused on males, chimpanzees, but also in other species. It was very rare actually for research effort to go into sort of females, and it was also sort of often presented that females were passive members of chimpanzee society, that they didn't really have agency or social relationships in the same way. And, you know, I think that's why she sort of calls out these stories to sort of highlight that, you know, now we sort of, in some ways, almost take it for granted that, of course, the females have very strong bonds in chimpanzee society. So they're what we call a matrilineal species, which means that the females have these sort of very close bonds with their mothers, but the females leave the social group when they're adolescents in for the most part, and they emigrate into new groups. And so this is a very risky operation for a young female, a teenage female chimpanzee to navigate, is to leave her mother, her sort of natal group, and create connections and allies and find mates in a new social group, in a new territory, in a new part of the environment. So there's so much to navigate. And I think, you know, when we sort of understood this sort of process that the females have to go through, it actually shows a lot of flexibility and therefore also, you know, a lot of, you know, agency in that moment, and about how they sort of choose their mates. And it's not to say it's all driven by the females. Of course, there's a chimpanzees that are led by the males. The males are definitely the dominant sex in chimpanzee society, but the females have, I think, you know, more choice and agency than was originally sort of ascribed to them. And a lot of that was just a lack of research effort.
Not to drill down too much here, because then I'll be canceled. But the idea is, what is it that, you know, one of the, I think Steve says in one of his interviews, the idea is when you study chimpanzees, you also may learn how to be a better parent yourself because of what you learned in the wild. But at the same time, these are also cannibalistic at times creatures. And the woman is willing to accept any number of mates. So there's like, okay, yeah, they're so much like us, but at the same time, their behaviors diverge in so many other ways too. And again, this laser focus sometimes makes it seem as if everybody says these are our closest relatives, they're our cousins, they share 99% of our DNA, but then their behaviors are so much different in so other many ways too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we are very closely related to chimpanzees genetically, but so we are to bonobos. And bonobos are the other sort of large African ape, along with gorillas. But bonobos and chimpanzees are very closely related to us, but they have very different social systems. And we know that genetics isn't the sole determinant of behavior and social responses. And also the genetic match isn't identical, right? They're not humans. They are closely related to us, but they are still separate from us. And I think we can look to them to learn, again, as I said, sort of maybe some shared traits with a common ancestor. But it's also important to know that, you know, they're chimpanzees, we're humans. And I think it's also equally important to think about bonobos, as well as gorillas and orangutans and other, you know, primate species, that so that we don't have this sort of vacuum view, and that we can take a more holistic and comparative approach. And I think that's really important when we're sort of, if we're ever drawing sort of parallels across species, whether it's to ourselves or across different primate species. And I mentioned it before, but the previous book that Steve and I co-edited, The Chimpanzees in Context, that was our whole sort of drive for that book, was it was putting chimpanzees in context of all other species. So we have folk in that book who work with other great ape species, but also with birds and with dolphins, to really, again, look at, well, what are these parallels? What are these differences? What's driven by the ecology and the environment? What sort of a developmental social pressure? So it's such a multifaceted question. And I think too, it's worth pointing out that there has been so much investment in chimpanzees relative to bonobos, and yet still there are so many unanswered questions about chimpanzees themselves. So even with this laser focus, there's still many, many unanswered questions about how they behave. And I think too, that's important why I was mentioning the chimpanzees. We think of them as the sort of monolith living in the jungles, but a lot of that is shaped by the early work of Jane studying the chimpanzees at Gombe. But if we look to the other communities that live in different environments or different parts, different countries within Africa, we see that their behavior is very different. The way they use tools is very different. Their hunting behavior varies considerably. Even some of their sort of social customs, their social style. So there's even been studies that have shown like the rates of sharing, tool sharing behavior differs across communities. So I think even when we're comparing chimpanzees and humans, that's tricky because we're not the same species. But it's also especially tricky because chimpanzees themselves aren't this singular unit. And we have to say, well, we share commonalities in this realm and not this, but also maybe with this community of chimpanzees and not with this one. So I think that's really important to highlight too.
It's interesting that you talk about these gaps, although there's gaps in the study of human beings and human society as well.
Absolutely, yes.
But at the same time, there's so many of you that are so fascinated and have spent so much time. What exactly are the gaps? What is it that you haven't learned and why haven't you learned it?
So I think one of the biggest factors is that chimpanzees are such a long-lived species and they have their offspring relatively late in life compared to some other species. And the intergenerational gap too. So the number of offspring that they have in a lifetime is extended. And so because of this, it takes literally decades to study a single chimpanzee's lifetime, let alone the outcome of their offspring's lives or their grandchildren and so on. So there's just a sort of a time scale that if you're comparing this to much shorter lived animals where you can study them much more relatively. I think another sort of hindrance has been that there's been a lot of focus at certain sites, but now as we're studying chimpanzees in more field sites and seeing that the commonalities, but also the differences across sites, that many things that maybe we held true as like, this is what chimpanzees do, we're now sort of questioning and that we're actually seeing greater variance than had originally thought in terms of even simple things like the size of the groups that they live in, the foods that they eat, the tools that they make, shows huge variance across cultures. So I think that's really important. And I think it's also, you know, sort of a battle that folk who work with chimpanzees in the wild are really having to take straight on now. And again, this is reflected by our contributors, is that many people went to the field as primatologists, just as you said, with this laser focus, just to study chimpanzees. And I think now we realize that we also have to be conservationists, we have to be activists, we have to be sociologists, we have to also be ecologists and study the other animals that are living in those communities too. You can't just have this sort of directed view on this one species. You need to step back and we also need to be doing work to conserve them, to protect them moving forward.
It's funny, I was talking about the divergence, but the one area that seems so resonant with human beings, and especially even though you can kind of hide behind your accent, you live in the United States and you've been watching our political process over the past 6 years. So I'm thinking about that as far as alpha males, dominance, bullies, switching in who's the leader. I'm thinking of Trump and Ron DeSantis right now. It's just so similar. If you want to hold a mirror up and also see the sometimes silliness, stupidity, bullying behaviors, those are behaviors that I guess all of you in the back of your heads, if not in the forefront, do compare to human society.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, so I have only ever really worked with chimpanzees in captive settings. And so one thing that affords me the luxury of is the facility where I trained to work had multiple groups of chimpanzees. And even though they all lived at the same place, they were all fed the same food, their enclosures were remarkably similar, each group had a completely different culture, a different way of being, a different sort of social dynamic. And this was all driven in part by who was the dominant male in that group, because each male has a different personality and they have a different leadership style. And that has this amazing sort of trickle-down effect to shaping the way that the group bonds, behaves, forms alliances. Franz de Waal talked about this, you know, very early on in his book, Chimpanzee Politics. But that was something, you know, as a young graduate student, I was sort of seeing play out in real life, that you could have two groups with exactly the same number of males and females, similar age compositions, but they would have these completely different social dynamics. You know, you could have sort of a very despotic male, you could have a very sort of egalitarian leader who was very good at sort of fostering and getting buy-in from his group members. And it's very striking. So I'm trained as a psychologist. That's my background. And so yeah, these sort of personality differences, these behavioral social dynamic differences are really interesting, and you can't help but thinking about how we work in human societies and how we sort of navigate common goals or disagreements for that matter.
Yeah, it'd be interesting if you could separate groups of human beings and captive and see how the political and social structure would evolve. Yeah, it's funny because I had another interview with someone, I can't remember who, and I was talking about my usual left-wing approach. How can someone be a QAnon person? How can someone have these thoughts? What an idiot they must be. And he goes, no, you can't do that. You may disagree with their core beliefs, but that doesn't change the fact that they're human beings, and those core beliefs simply give rise to their own particular logic and modus vivendi. And I thought about it a lot, and it kind of made me settle down a bit.
Yeah, I think, you know, what you've just said there really resonates with me, because it reminds me of, so Steve did a lot of work trying to rehabilitate chimpanzees that were in the US in captive settings that were less than ideal. So whether these were chimpanzees that were owned privately as pets, or whether they were sort of in unaccredited sort of roadside attractions, Steve was very active in trying to get those animals relocated to accredited zoos and sanctuaries to have a better life. And the way that he achieved this and was so successful in this was by building long-term relationships with many people with whom he had, you know, strong disagreements with, right, as to ideologically about how they were, you know, caring for their chimpanzees. But the only way you can sort of bridge that gap and sort of create change is by sort of meeting somebody and trying to understand where they're coming from and what motivates them. And, you know, one thing I think he found universally that was, even if folk weren't taking care of the chimpanzee in a way that we would recommend or that was best for the animals, in many cases, these people loved their animals and thought that they were doing the best thing. So you can find that commonality in a love of chimpanzees, and then you can sort of create the behavior change. And through that process, and, you know, for many years, sometimes working with these people and just slowly building relationships, he was able to rehome many, many chimpanzees. So I think, yeah, that's a testament to sort of like his ability to look past sometimes those sort of ideological differences, but yeah, it can be tricky for sure.
Well, it's like, you know, in America, essentially, civil discourse seems to have disappeared. And the January 6th hearings are going on today, and there's different opinions about all of that, whether you listen to Fox News or CNN. And I realize neither of those are right. They're just different opinions. And my anger is a visceral response. It reminds me of the one, I can't remember his name, the one chimpanzee who was he was an alpha, he was a mediator. And when there became two fights, he would just sit in between and yes, essentially be a Jimmy Carter kind of presence.
Yes, yes. And,
yeah, talk about him. And then how he began grieving and kind of, he changed his mind. He just couldn't, after his friend died, you know? That was,
yeah,
that's a human story.
Yeah, so that was in John Matani's chapter about the Ngogo chimpanzees. And yeah, it's a really remarkable story. This male was a true peacekeeper, and really, I think sometimes, yeah, we've talked earlier about the violence, right, and how aggressive chimpanzees can be, but they can also be incredibly socially savvy and incredibly flexible, and that I think is really described beautifully by John here with this particular individual who was, yeah, the ultimate peacekeeper, and was really, would actively go out of his way to sort of mediate aggression that was happening in his group and to sort of protect vulnerable individuals within his group. And John later talks about when his sort of closest ally and friend dies that he mourned the loss of his friend, and you can sort of see this in his behavior. And you know, there are many sort of accounts of chimpanzees and other primates, and indeed other species, sort of mourning or seemingly mourning, you know, when an individual dies. And even with chimpanzees, we often see mothers whose infants have died at a very young age will carry around their baby for days, sometimes even weeks after it's died. So I think there is definitely this side of chimpanzees that's maybe less salacious than the aggressive sort of territorial males that we often hear about, but I think to me that's what makes them so interesting, is that they can be both and everything. They can be incredibly sensitive and show incredible nuance in their response, and they are always sort of seemingly just watching what everybody else is doing and preempting the behavior of others and planning others. So they're not just sort of these sort of robots that are reacting in real time. They are preempting their social maneuverings and protecting their allies in many cases.
The more I think about this, it's like if I think of the Yalta conference and Stalin and Roosevelt and Churchill and then Hitler, you go, I can also place these in chimpanzees culture, and it's almost the perfect template. Or you could do today a movie, it might actually be helpful, with someone playing Trump and someone playing Boris Johnson and someone playing Putin. And there's corollaries, are there not? I mean, it's really fun. You don't want to get political. I have the luxury of being able to.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can't sort of take these, I don't think you can transfer these analogies literally from chimpanzee society to human society. I think there's nuances and differences there, but for sure, chimpanzees definitely are all individuals and they navigate their social situations as individuals. So some are very socially savvy, some are really socially inept, some are much more aggressive and despotic, and others are much more sort of egalitarian. And I think that's what makes it such an interesting species to study, because you see these differences and you see how they're navigating each other within that space.
Yeah, but the thing about it is that you can't have your cake and eat it too, in a sense that when the older scientists argue that you're anthropomorphizing the creatures, you are. You guys are doing that. And the essays reflect that. And so,
yes.
Yeah, so you are. You are giving them human traits. I'm not saying this the right way, but you attribute attributes to them that are the same attributes that we share. And you start by giving them names. And then by giving them names, you make them individuals. And then by making them individuals, you give them specific traits, whether it's empathy or whether it's bulliness or whether it's kindness or whether it's a maternal instinct. And so I it's very hard for me not to transfer that directly to people I know.
So for sure, I think the way we study the individual differences is in a very sort of, you know, I'm doing this sort of big brush strokes today, but like, of course, we use very, you know, detailed methods to do that, right? We're recording their behavior in a very methodical way. We're doing these, I mean, literally takes hours, days, months, years to build up these pictures. Whereas I think with people, we're making, you know, snapshots for sure. So there, of course, there are absolutely parallels. And I think what we need to be careful with is that we're allowing their behavior to drive the narrative rather than for us to come in with some sort of a priori ideas about how they're going to behave. So I think for me, that's maybe the difference.
Yeah, well, when you guys get together, you can't tell me that you've never said, this guy is exactly like...
Oh, we, for sure, like we all talk about the animals that we work with as if, you know, they are our friends. Like we of course, we know them very, very well. For many of us, we've been working with them for many, many years. In the same way that, you know, with your own pets, right? We know different personalities about our pets, right? No two pet is the same. And so it's definitely the same with the chimpanzees, for sure.
You know, as Steve says, I guess, in his interviews and in the essays, you know, one of the reasons you use the people you use is he says, you know, candidly, that Some of them are reaching the end of their careers. This is almost, these essays are almost like a capstone.
Yes.
Because where they became slightly uncomfortable is they're telling us who they are rather than what they do. And that's what I think was so cool about the book.
Thank you. Yeah, I remember viscerally, like we hosted this meeting and it sort of happened organically, but many of the folks, so many of the people that contributed to this book, so John Matani and Pusey, spoke at the meeting. And some of them actually were sort of actively reflecting and saying, this might be the last meeting I speak at, right? And Steve and I were sitting there thinking, this truly could be, because this meeting is typically held, this, as I said, it was the fourth in a series. They're typically held about every 10 years. So we were thinking, well, by the time the next one comes around, many of these people will have retired and they won't be present at this meeting. And this truly could be the last one in this series that they're speaking at. And I remember it just dawning on us sort of almost simultaneously in this moment. And that's why we really felt like there has to be some way to sort of gather the information. And I think for me, what was a real joy is I've been in this field for many years myself. I know many of these people quite well. And yet so many of these stories were completely new to me that I hadn't heard. So my PhD advisor is one of the contributors, Andy Whiten. And I feel like I know him very, very well. We've worked together for, 20 years now. And there were still like little snippets, even in his story, that I was like, oh, I had no idea. And for other people, I didn't know their stories at all. And so I'm, you know, just very selfishly, it was such a joy to put this book together, you know, just Steve and I, like when we would, you know, get the essays from our contributors or when we would interview them, like it was just so fun to like learn those stories. And we were like, did you see so-and-so said this? I'm like, oh my gosh, so-and-so said this. Like we didn't know. And so if nothing else, it was a complete joy. And Steve and I were putting the final edits together through like the peak of the COVID lockdown period. And, you know, that was a tough time, right? A time of great uncertainty and a time of isolation. And so to have this sort of international project where people were emailing and sharing, reminiscing, and it was a really fun project to work through during that time.
And it definitely comes through, both in his foreword, your afterwards, and in the enthusiasm. Each essay was enthusiastic, which is unusual. Oh, and so in conclusion, and I almost forgot it, and you would not forgive me, is that we haven't talked about the illustrations in the slightest, and they're fantastic.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so the illustrations throughout the book, so I have the book, so the cover is beautiful. Actually, my favorite thing, and I didn't know this was going to be the thing, but it's the little chimpanzee that sits across the title on the spine. But yeah, so dotted throughout this book, let me see if I should have pin marked these before we started speaking. But throughout the book are these beautiful illustrations of different chimpanzees. And we asked our contributors to, you know, each sort of speak to some of the chimpanzees or a particular chimpanzee that had really left an impression on them. And again, because Steve and I were very keen to highlight individual chimpanzees, not chimpanzees as a species, but the individual lives of the people and the individual lives of the chimpanzees. And we also were sort of thinking about the early field notes that many field researchers, including Jane, keep. And these often include sketches. That's how they identify the individuals that they work with. And so we wanted this to feel almost like field notes with somebody's sketches of the chimpanzees that they had worked with. And so that was the sort of the style that we wanted to go with. And we were trying to think of who we could invite. And we were looking around at different illustrators. And then I think Steve speaks about it in the book, but he was, so at the zoo, he was in a colleague's office and there was this beautiful illustration of a lion on her wall. And it turns out it was illustrated by Dawn Schuerman, who worked in the zoo's nutrition center. So, you know, devising and preparing all of the diets and the meals for all of the animals in the zoo. So an incredibly sort of integral role to the health of the zoo animals. But Dawn is also an incredibly talented illustrator, and we approached her and she was so excited to be involved in this project. So we asked our contributors to send in photos of the chimpanzees that they had called out in their essays, and Dawn illustrated all of them. And it's this really beautiful element to the book, that it's not just sort of these essays, but it's also these glimpses, and definitely the feel that we wanted to give was this sort of, yeah, field notes with these hand-drawn illustrations. And I think Dawn's style like complements that perfectly.
Yeah, I had noticed at the beginning when I saw illustrated, but I didn't think much about it. And then when I turned the page and I saw the first picture, I go, wow. And then the texture and the fact that they're like pencil makes sense. I wouldn't want, it's better than photographs. It's better than the photographs of the animals. There's so much more personality that comes through.
I think so, yes. So it's really lovely to hear you say that. That was nice that you stumbled across them in that way. Yeah.
Well, so I guess to close is, as always, as I do in every single interview, it's probably tedious to others, but I'll say the same way I always say it. People come in and they say, you can't judge a book by its cover. And every single person, everyone without exception,
yes,
comes in and judges the book by its cover. And that's why,
of course,
and that's why publishers like to pick the covers, because they want to sell books. But
yes,
It's a great cover. And anybody who's interested in animals in general, or chimpanzees in specific, I've watched them, you know, they just come in, they go, ooh, and they pick up the book, and hopefully most times they buy it. So in any event, thank you so much, Lydia, for joining us today. Once again, I'm so sorry that Steve couldn't be here with us. And like I said, I really enjoyed the book, and I really enjoyed going down the rabbit hole of researching for the interview and seeing Jane Goodall's videos and the hoots, which are embarrassing to me sometimes, but.
Yes, she is renowned for her ability to imitate chimpanzee vocalizations.
She does a good job. So. Can you do it?
No. I'm far too introverted for that.
Well, thanks so much, Lydia. I really appreciate it.
It was absolutely my pleasure. This was a joy to talk about, and thank you so much.
You're welcome.